Six music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today, my guest is a remarkable and utterly unique musician. He originally found fame with his 1973 album Tubular Bells, completely composed and performed on his own when he was just 20. That masterpiece, aside from launching Virgin Records, became one of the biggest albums of the decade. In the years that followed, his career helped shape what we know as prog, ambient, new age, minimalist, and even world music, sometimes blending all of them. My guest on The First Time this week is Mike Oldfield. Here Mike talks us through his earliest musical memories, the early guitar heroes that shaped his distinctive style, and his first live music experiences as part of the burgeoning folk scene in his hometown of Reading in the 60s. We cover his time playing and working with Soft Machine alumni and psychedelic music icon Kevin Ayres, the creation of the remarkable Tubular Bells, and the fallout of his huge success. Mike also talks about the obsessions that drove him to make acclaimed albums like Hergest Ridge and Omadorn, the latter of which he's just revisited for a new album, Return to Omadorn, as well as his own battles with mental health and his triumphant appearance at the 2012 Olympic Games opening ceremony. But I started by asking Mike, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
What popped into my head is Bill and Ben, the flowerpot men.
Bill and Ben.
Muffin the Mule.
We want Muffin the Mule. Hear a Muffin
play. Oh, what was that thing now? In the Light programme, I wrote in and asked for the Teddy Bear's Picnic.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you bet.
And they never played it. And I listened for weeks and weeks and weeks, but they never played my request. I'm still very upset about it.
When you were small, did you have a fascination with music? Do you see it as something special?
Well, there was two things. One was my mother loved opera. You know, we had normal dansette or whatever it was, and she would play Mario Lanza, singer. She loved the Madame Butterfly, so I would hear that coming out. And when she wasn't playing music, my sister would be playing things like Elvis Presley and also some classical music. I remember coming home from school one day and Beethoven's Fifths was playing on the dance set. My jaw dropped and I said, "What's that?" You know, it's going da-da-da-da, and all the violins da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm just enraptured by Beethoven's Fifth. And then, so I looked at the sleeve, and I discovered that in Reading, where we grew up, there was a record library. So I can't remember what I got out of there, but I started looking into other Beethoven tracks. I think Beethoven was the first composer that I became aware of. And then Wagner.
Pretty heavy stuff.
Well, I mean, I was only six, you know. I can't play my musical taste. It was whatever was in the rack. I think, oh, what's this? Who's he? And then it was a real fantastic time for, you know, the birth of rock and roll. This would have been 1960, 1961. I remember that when the Beatles released their first track. And I remember the first Stones track. Fantastic time. No, you couldn't wait for Sunday afternoon with Alan Freeman, his Pick of the Pops, you know, you couldn't wait for that, and it was really exciting. And obviously for the next 10 years, you know, I grew up with that, all these things, so I was kind of riding the crest of that wave as a listener, at the same time growing my own musical abilities, became a fairly accomplished folk acoustic guitar player.
Was it your dad's old guitar that you saw hanging up on the wall, your first guitar?
Yes, well, he had a little bit of musical ability. He played three or four chords, and he used to do everything every Christmas, I think. He'd do his two songs, Danny Boy, and something called The Blue Tail Fly by Burl Ives.
Jimmy Crackhorn and I don't care, Jimmy Crackhorn and I don't care, Jimmy Crackhorn and I don't care, my master's gone away.
And I grew up with this guitar on the wall, and I think one day I said, "Can you show me how to play it, Dad?" And he showed me C, F and G, which is all he knew, and I could just play C. F was real difficult. You had to kind of stretch. It was really painful. So we must have all evolved over that. Folk was very fashionable in those days, and Reading had a good selection of folk clubs. We used to go down there, and people would put little adverts in the music shop saying, looking for partner for a folk band. And I joined a couple of duos there and actually played in folk clubs in Reading. One of them was called The Rising Sun, I think. I can't remember the other one.
What about your first gig?
I think in Reading Town Hall they had variety shows. Probably very small. I was taken along to them. In one of these variety shows, my sister Sally was a ballerina. And then after that, it was just folk clubs. I can't even remember my first rock gig.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your love of Hank Marvin.
Well, I'd heard that coming on the radio. Things like Apache, you know, The Shadows. Oh, I thought that was fantastic sound. I must have seen a picture of them in a magazine. I saw the pink Strat, you know, at the bottom of our street. There was an Exchange and Mart. And in there was a very cheap red electric guitar. I pestered my dad for weeks, you know. £6, I think it was. I said, please, I want them, I want them, I want them, I want them, I want them. Came back from school one day and there it was in my bedroom. So, it wasn't a Fender Stratocaster, but it was it was called a Futurama 2, whatever that was. Saw The Shadows on TV, I think, and I got one of their records. Used to be able to go into record stores and listen in the little booth then, so I'd spend my weekends in the booth. Probably didn't have enough money to buy anything, but, you know, and they eventually kicked me out, listening to stuff for free. Just this burning memory of listening to Pick of the Pops, Alan Freeman, walking down the stone steps of Reading Bridge with my little transistor radio and hearing the rise and fall of Flingle Bunt. And everybody was on the side of the river, a lovely sunny day, and people fishing and everybody playing around us. And I thought, oh, I'm in heaven, you know, I love this music.
We should mention Bert Jansch as well. When did you first hear him? He's an amazing player and obviously a big folk guitar hero of yours.
Well, yes. Again, it was my sister would play Bert Jansch records. And I thought, what is that? I'd already had a very simple, cheap acoustic guitar and I was learning, you know, working on my three chords, C, F and G. Now, one day, my sister brought a boyfriend back. So, you know, I learned quite a lot from her various boyfriends. And one of them was a guitar player. And I heard him play, and he was playing pretty good, you know, fingerstyle folk, complicated fingerstyle. And I just decided there and then that I was going to learn how to play like that. I was able to, when my sister was out, listen to her Bert Jansch and John Renborn, who's also fantastic records, keep putting the needle on, listening to, you know, a little snippet of guitar instrumental, and then I'd learn how to play it and force myself to learn to play it exactly. When I got that bit, I'd put to the next bit and the next bit, and this took months, a year or so maybe, just to, you know, learn the two tracks on one album. But by the end of it, I could do it. And so that was the crucible of my guitar playing technique, was learning these things note for note.
She throws her arms around me like a circle round the sun. Laid down last night just a trying to take my rest. Laid down last night, I was a trying to take my rest. But my mind got to wandering like wild geese in the
how to play it, then I could extemporize, I could, you know, add to them, and gradually I was starting to make my own music and playing in the local folk clubs. There was two in Reading. First one was the Rising Sun, I can't remember the other one. Then I got a duo with a friend of mine, then I joined another duo and we'd play in the club. I started to, you know, play in front of, it was only like 50 people, you know, but they liked it. I got the feeling for a live gig, and you can tell when you're getting through and they like it. I was very nervous about it. And so shortly after that, we left Reading and things developed. You know, I moved to Essex. My sister got a record contract. I left school. That's where it all started. And then that led on to Kevin Ayers and, you know.
He was quite a mercurial chap. What was he like to work with? What were your first impressions of him?
Oh, he was a star, charismatic. Oh, it's lovely. He became a sort of, you know, mentor, uncle. You know, he'd teach me things about life, probably not very good things. It was how to not care about things, you know, how to sit in cafes drinking wine and looking at things in a very... They called him the Noel Coward of rock and roll, you know, so I sort of picked up a little bit on that. In order to get the job, I was at Black Hill Enterprises, Kevin Ayers' agent. And anyway, I was at their offices in Notting Hill Gate, and they said, go for this interview. It's at Manchester Square, just off Oxford Street. You know, a chap called Kevin Ayres looking for a bass player. I said, well, I haven't got an amplifier or a guitar. Oh, well, there's one in the back room. I didn't have any money for a taxi. Nobody thought about how I'm going to actually get it there. So there's a massive 4x12 cabinet, which weighed half a ton. So I had to pick that up, walk 100 yards down the street, come back for the amp top, which also was full of valves and heavy stuff, and then the guitar case, take them and go like a centipede, you know, back and forth. And then I had to go on the tube. So I had to go down the escalator carrying the 4x12, drop it down there, get the escalator back up to the top. Then I had to get inside the tube, and I had to quickly, with the 30 seconds that the doors open, get the 4x12 in the tube and get back out and get the cabinet and the guitar and get in before the doors shut. Otherwise, it would have gone off with my amp. Anyway, I managed to get to the audition in a, you know, with my tongue hanging out to the floor in exhaustion. And somehow I managed to still play the bass a bit after that ordeal. You can't say it's been an easy ride sometimes, you know. Anyway, I got the gig, yes. When I first met Kevin, I thought he was lovely, and he gave me the job on the spot, actually. The only trouble was I was only 16, and I wasn't allowed to travel abroad without a chaperone. So every time we went to Holland or Germany or France, we had to go and see a judge. I had to get a permit, then I had to have a chaperone, and it couldn't be Kevin. So it was normally somebody from the Black Hill office had to go along as my chaperone. It's a legal requirement, apparently, till I was 17 or 18.
So this is all when you're very, very young?
That's right, yes. I just out of school, yes.
The studio is obviously somewhere really special to you. Can you remember the first time you went to a proper recording studio, your first experience?
The very first was in the basement of Black Hill Enterprises. Just to explain, Black Hill was a shop front, and then there was a few desks. It was run by Peter Jenner and Andrew King, who were involved very early on with the very original Pink Floyd. Yes, it was in the basement there. There was a somebody, no, still don't know who he was, had a one-track tape recorder, and they gave me a couple of hours down there. And if you remember what became the caveman section of Tubular Bells with the screaming Neolithic vocals. Recorded that in Black Hill, and nobody thought it was any good, so it probably got put in the bin. So. Then the next recording session I went to was in the absolute temple of Studio Number 2 Abbey Road, which was fantastic, you know. Walking in there, it was such an Aladdin's cave of instruments which were just lying around. You know, there was everything from orchestral timpani, there was a beautiful harpsichord, there was two incredible grand pianos, Steinways, I think. There's even a set of tubular bells, I remember. They're all just there. I think the first session I did with Kevin Ayres, you know, I did what was expected, and I think we were booked in the next day at something like 11 o'clock, and I suddenly thought to myself, I'm going to come in early. I think it was outside the doors before it opened, and I got in there at something like 7:30 or 8 o'clock, so I had 3 hours alone with all these instruments in that studio, which was absolutely fantastic, because I could play these things. I mean, you have to understand, I was just penniless musician without anything, just to be able to play a real concert Steinway piano, that was like, you know, for me, being in heaven. The only piano I'd played was my grandma's pub piano, because she used to play things like Roll Out the Barrel in the pubs in, you know, in the old days, or the olden days, as my kids call it.
And music even then was really special. It was almost something sacred.
How to describe it. It was a world there that just really resonated with my inner self, and I thought, this is fantastic. You know, I wasn't anybody gave it to me, it was just I discovered it, you know, and I can't really explain it. I've thought about this a lot, but I think I was born with a musical brain, and it's like suddenly I was plugged into my source of energy, you know. This is what I've been looking for, you know. I had a similar experience when I had my first beer. I thought it was wonderful.
That was Caveman from the original 1971 demos that would eventually be reworked as Tubular Bells by my guest on the first time this week, Mike Oldfield.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Mike Oldfield. And that was an excerpt from Mike's 1975 album, Omadorn. Taking it back a couple of years, I asked Mike if he could remember when he first got the idea for the concept of the album that would start his career, Tubular Bells.
Yes, I had ideas and asked Kevin Ayres if I could borrow his tape recorder. He very kindly loaned it to me, and by that time we were all living, three of us, in the same house in Tottenham, and we all had our rooms there. So after the gig, I asked the roadie if he could take the organ out of the van, and it was a Farfisa organ. And then there was things like Terry Riley was happening then, there was Centipede, a vast jazz rock orchestra with fantastic musicians. Terry Riley's Rainbow in Curved Air, that was a different... That was had one sequence. Do 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 do. And the other half of the sequence is the same sequence, but delayed by two or four beats. And I learned how to play them together in different hands. So it's like rubbing your tummy and banging your head. So I learned how to do that. I said, right, I'm going to do something of my own. And I switched on the tape recorder, switched on the organ, and played it exactly like it always has been straight away. I thought, well, that'll do. The demos have been released, and those are still the same demos. And then we had a little bag on stage where we used to have percussion toys, things like maracas and tambourines, and there was a little sort of bell tree there, almost a children's toy, and I thought, oh, it'd be nice if I put these little dingy-dingy-dingy-dingy bells on there. So that's on the original demo. And then I thought, all right, this is great, everybody's going to love this. So it went to Kevin Ayres Record Company. To give him credit, there was a chap called Nick Mobbs, I think his name was. He's the only person who showed any interest in it. He showed a little bit of interest. Then I had to wait for a year or more before I was told, no, we're not interested. Meanwhile, I went round to all the other record companies who basically thought I was out of my mind, you know. And I went to, Pi, CBS, all thought I was crazy, you know, because it didn't have any vocals, you know.
Did you always have absolute faith in it?
I remember just when I was working on the demos in Tottenham, and I went to the top of the street, and there was a park up there, and I was sitting in the park, spring I think it was. I just had this picture in my head that it was going to be very successful. I don't know if it hadn't been successful, people would have said, like, I was mad, you know, but because it was successful and made me, you know, against all the odds that it was, it gave me a little bit of an eerie feeling of premonitions. I felt that it would be, and all the evidence was that it wasn't going to be. Then Kevin Ayres folded, and I got the job playing for this musician called Arthur Louis, and we went to the Manor to rehearse. And they hadn't even built the studio then, and I still had my demo tapes, which I'd made on Kevin Ayres' little machine with me, and I played them to the engineers there. They played them to Simon Draper. I don't even know if Simon played them to Richard Branson, because Richard Branson wasn't really interested in music at all. But Simon Draper liked them, and eventually I got my big chance, and that's how it all happened.
I was going to ask you about your first impressions of Richard Branson.
I think the first time I saw him, there was a big disturbance in the kitchen at the Manor, and this chap came running into the kitchen, in blood, with his hair sticking up on the end, and then I think he started writhing on the floor. Everybody was going, shock, horror, call the police, call the ambulance. Then suddenly he burst out laughing, and in his hand was a bottle of iodine. And he thought, this is incredibly hilariously funny, because he just tried to convince anybody that somebody tried to murder him. this is his idea of a practical joke. I think that's the first time I ever met him. And, yeah, he had wiry hair, and I never spoke to him because I was just, a session man for the band that was in there. And then next time I met him, I was invited for a very smart, posh meal on his boat in Little Venice. This was when Simon Draper had persuaded him to give me a week in the studio, and I was invited for dinner. He begrudgingly agreed with Simon Draper to give me a week. I think the thing he didn't like was perhaps I had this list of instruments which I needed. He was looking how much they were all going to cost to hire, needing all kinds of different kinds of guitars and pianos and organs and percussions and all this stuff. So after the week, Simon Draper was over the moon about the actual recording, and Richard kind of fell in with him, yes. And then there was a funny thing. They all went off to Medem, where they played it to somebody from Atlantic in the States, and they said, yeah, it'd be all right as long as it had some vocals.
Tubular Bells was a huge hit you know, sold 17 million copies, was in the charts for like nearly 5.5 years. There's no preparation for that level of success, is there?
Well, no, nobody recognised me. They still don't, which is nice. I like to keep it that way. But I do remember phones didn't stop ringing. People wanted to talk to me. I made a lot of enemies. I understand now by people wanting to talk to me and not agreeing to talk to them. I was out in my cottage in the Welsh hillside surrounded by my sheep. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't like it then.
Yeah, because it's just you bearing all the load. You're the only composer, you're the only musician.
I think I should have taken a few years off and done something else after Tubular Bells, but you know, there was such pressure. I mean, to make another one, because obviously the first one was almost like for a record company suddenly winning the jackpot. It's like, wow, this is great! Oh, cool, do another one, get more money! Oh. And there's this, like, 20-year-old. So I basically didn't know what was going on, and I was still maturing as a human being, you know, and that thrust upon you, I just ran away from it, really. I mean, nobody can understand that. It doesn't seem to be, you know. Then you think, wasn't it great? Wasn't it wonderful? I'm sorry, no.
Tubular Bells was 72, but in the following 2 years, you released Her Guest Ridge and Omadawn, which you're now revisiting for the new album.
Her Guest Ridge was the follow-up to Tubular Bells, right? And it got absolutely slammed and hammered by it critically. Even though it went in at number one, you know, With Omadawn, I sort of had to do something to be as perfect at the time as it could possibly be. The Omadawn that ended up as the master was actually the second Omadawn. I had made the whole thing once before, and I'd played the tape so many times that the tape had fallen to pieces, and I'd copied it so many times that the quality got so bad that there was no alternative but me to completely start again. So it was a very incisive, highly powered album, and I finally got the hang of producing. First album I ever produced myself, and got the best performances out of everybody. Got that fantastic African drum section, but not without a hell of a lot of work, you know, and encouragement and manipulation and.
So blending African rhythms and rock and Irish chants, that hadn't really been done before at that point?
No, to blend African drums with sort of Irish vocals, no. But I'd never seen any distinction in different kinds of music. No difference between Beethoven and Led Zeppelin and, you know, Bert Jansch, Bob Dylan, country music, you know, bluegrass. And all this is just different sounds, you know. I don't see any reason why I shouldn't use all of them in together in one piece. You know, you can have a little bit of Kerrang metal guitar there along with a recorder. I've since learnt that certain instruments suggest things in people's minds, you know, and that can be uncool. You know, things that I've learnt, tried to understand what the hell they mean by cool and uncool, and certain things are cool and certain things are uncool. And I'm still trying to get my head around what it actually means, but what would be an uncool thing? Oh, me, I suppose. Who does absolutely everything all mixed up in a big pot without giving a damn what people think. It was a tremendous success, critically and, you know, sales-wise. But after that, that's when I really should have taken a break. But instead, you know, I got pressured into working again, and I made Incantations, which, you know, it's not my favourite album at all. And then after that, then it was a strange mixture of albums, which led to probably the best thing that came out of that was the song Moonlight Shadow. And it was a hell of a long journey to get there.
Lost in a riddle that Saturday night, far away.
This is the first time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Mike Oldfield. Despite the success of his albums, Mike found himself unhappy with a lot of the pressures that came with fame and was plagued by depression, something he battled successfully, but that had an unwanted impact on his creativity.
The reason why the first three albums stand out and the reason why they're still the most popular is because after those, my understanding of myself became just, I was so confused. Okay, yes, I could go into a studio and make music, but the rest of being a human being, I wasn't comfortable with myself. So I went through a long process of self-discovery, aided by various very, very clever, very helpful people. And I came to terms with my own humanity, if you like. And as a result, was a much calmer, contented person. But my creativity suffered. It seems that you know, the more unhappy, the more stressful, the more problems you have in your life, the more there's an incentive to create something which is the opposite of it. Now, I used to do that with my music. I used to hide in my music. I'd not exactly hide in it. I lived in a musical world. I had to create an alternate reality in those days, and when I did manage to sort myself out, I got no more need for that reality. So I also carried on making music, but it didn't have the concrete foundations of being a necessary thing that I had to have.
In 2012, Mike performed live at the Olympics opening ceremony, introducing his music to a whole new audience and sparking re-interest in his work. But this positivity was tragically derailed when just 2 years later, his son Dougal died unexpectedly, aged just 33, which provided the drive to create his new album, Return to Omadhon.
The Olympic Games was such an incredible high, and the feeling at the time was something very, very special, because it's not like an ordinary gig. It's a nation. To have it's 17 minutes. The main part of it was an hour. 17 minutes. It's quite a large chunk of that. It was the National Health Service, and both my parents were in the National Health Service. The sound, everything is the best of the best of the best that our nation could offer. And I was just so proud to be a part of it. And then I didn't know what I thought I was going to do after that, but, you know, now I know. It was just life did one of its, balancing acts, and just made the last 4 years of my life so unbelievably stressful. That's all I can say about it, that I've been reborn in me the need to create music, which was the opposite of that. Circumstances of the last 4 years made it. I had to make that album. Sometimes it makes me wonder that there's some guiding force, you know, somewhere. I think, okay, we want a really powerful album out of you, so we're going to make your life hell so that you have to do it. So, because it's, you know, that's my reaction to a bad time is it comes out in music.
This new version of Omadhon, Return to Omadhon, feels very physical. Feels like, you know, all the instruments are played by you with your fingers.
Because that is what it is. There's nothing. It's not hand played and not real. You know, there's sometimes I play and I'm amazed watching myself as I think of something and there it instantly is in sound. Very rarely I have to stop and work something out. It's difficult, probably, for other people to understand. But I'm a totally musical thing. It's not the second in my whole life, 63 years of it, that I haven't had music in my head the whole time, even at night. I'm still like that. It's sort of automatic. It's almost like a music box that never unwinds. And even rhythms, I've got rhythms in my fingers and playing the guitar all the time.
And to end, what should we play? The choice is yours. What should we end on?
Well, you could play the... I love the chant where the African drums come in. It's just drums and chant. It's not even a chant. It's a kind of spell that I've managed to conjure up using bits of the old album and all kinds of modern technology, the DNA of the original Omadhon. But the African drums part, the big solo there, you know. So it's bad mood music, you know. It's get it all out music, you know. Spine tingling for me anyway, and I'm very pleased that I managed to do that.
Six Music.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.